All right, so now what we can do is to look at two cases, these elliptic regular guys. It sort of depends what kind of torus they're in, unramified versus ramified, and we'll just see what the fixed point sets look like. Then we can find out what that number is, and the thing in the brackets will actually simplify in a nice way. So case one, they're just the two cases, unramified and ramified. I'll start with unramified, where we need an unramified quadratic extension, like so. And I'll write the Galois group as being 1, comma, bar. Okay, so conjugation in that for that Galois group is. What? We are going to calculate this number. All right. And the trick that here I'm using the same method as in that reference I gave to Langlands, GL2 base change. The trick is to actually think about your tree as being a subtree of the tree you get for GL2 over the bigger field. All right, so we have GL2. Now I need to emphasize the fields. And of course, here we have Q being the cardinality of the residue field, and it's unramified. So now we're taking a quadratic extension, and we'll get Q squared. All right, so in the case that people like to draw on the board, where that you take as few as possible, if we take Q to be 2, then we'll have Q squared to be 4. And the way the picture looks is, okay, I'll start off with the one. That's the beginning of the tree for something where the residue field has 2 elements. Okay, maybe a little more. But now, we just are going to have 5 guys coming out, or 2 more coming out of each location. That's all. And of course, these things themselves will continue to branch. And so there's a lot more stuff now. And we can do our calculation by reducing to the thing that we already did, but up on the bigger field. Because when we take, now I need my gamma. Okay, so gamma, what's the torus I'm talking about? Yeah, maybe I should write that first. So the torus T is just E star sitting inside of our group, GL2F, G. But we're interested in things that are conjugate to something in K. So inside here, we've got the units. And that's really where I'm going to be taking my gamma, but I don't want it to be in the center. We've already treated those, and they would behave differently. That means we don't want them to be in the smaller field. And now what happens is when you pass to this larger field E, then gamma becomes diagonalizable. All right, so this thing is conjugate over E to, and when you put it into diagonal form, you'll have the eigenvalues being gamma and this conjugate of gamma under the Galois element here. Which means that we know what happens in this bigger tree where we have all the stuff coming from E. Namely, we saw from last time that we need to form the quantity D of gamma. This is from previous work. It's the valuation of 1 minus, and then we had the root, which is the ratio of the eigenvalues, so it'll be gamma over gamma bar. I mean, this won't change. If I put gamma bar over gamma, you get the same number, so that's okay. We have this thing here, which is some non-negative integer. last time, we saw that in this larger tree, then there's some apartment. It won't be the standard one anymore because this gamma, it's only conjugate to this thing, which means that the apartment that's relevant for this element here is a transform of the standard one, not the standard one. But anyway, there's some apartment where the fixed point set is just all the things that are within distance this amount of that new apartment. What does that new apartment look like? There's some apartment, and it's all, well, there's this point here, and then using this convention of putting the new stuff in the new color, the situation is actually like this. So this is, somehow this is the apartment relevant for gamma over the field E. That's not the standard one. There's, how do you produce it? You take a group element that conjugate, this would be a group element in GL2 of the big field E. You take a group element that conjugates this guy. Well, we have to embed that thing in, sorry. Did I do that? Yeah. We have to take a group element which conjugates this over to this, and then that, I guess the inverse of that group element will move the standard apartment to the one that I want. Now the deal is, this is, well, let me also say it in lattice terms. How do you, in case you know that point of view, we don't absolutely need it, but if you know that point of view, it's handy. The way you embed E star into our group G is by thinking about E as being a two-dimensional F vector space, and then you can multiply by things in E, and that serves to embed E star into 2x2 matrices. We can do the same thing with our, you know, this like so. And OE cross will map into K if we set things up right, because what we can do is choose a basis that's simultaneous. I mean, it'll be choose a basis for O of E as an OF module. Do that, and that's sort of stronger than choosing a basis for E as an F vector space. So choose a basis for the OE, OF module OE, and use that to identify things with GL2. And then you have this, and if I do things this way, and we think in terms of lattice classes, this vertex here is the lattice class of OE. So that sort of makes sense. That's going to be, when you have any one of these gammas that are coming out of OE cross, they'll preserve that lattice because OE cross just takes OE to OE. All right, so any gamma fixes this thing. But now we get our final answer because, sorry? Well, yeah, it depends how you're thinking about it. This is actually a point in the original tree. And when you think about it that way, it's this point here. Yes, when we embedded it in the larger one, and we identify, so when we actually look, all right, so that OE is sitting in this original E, okay, as a lattice in that two-dimensional vector space. But then if you tensor everything with E, we have that, okay, and that's two-dimensional over E, and then we would have OE tensored over OF with OE sitting inside of there. And then this thing here, because it's unramified, I mean, we're using that OE is, that E is that unramified over F, this is actually just a product sitting inside, and this is a product. So that's kind of the picture, whole picture of everything over both the small field and after extending scalars to the bigger field. But anyway, this answers our problem because, our question, because how, you know, whether or not something is fixed, depends on how far it is, how far it is from that point to this apartment. But if we're dealing with one of these points that's coming from the tree for the small field, then when we're going to be able to join it by a shortest path to this apartment, but it's going to have to be joined to that point. And so the distance from any one of these points in the small tree to that apartment is just equal to the distance of that point to this point. So we get our answer. In other words, let me call this, our answer is that the fixed point set consists of those vertices such that the distance from that vertex to this one. Is less than or equal to d sub gamma. Well, it's easy to calculate that number because we know, just once again, using every vertex as q plus 1 neighbors, we get 1 from the point right in the middle. That point has q plus 1 neighbors, et cetera. And actually what we have is 2 plus 1, and then 1 plus, I have to sort of keep going. I'm just counting things according to how, grouping things according to how far they are from that guy in the middle. And we get this, which boils down to 1 plus q plus 1, q to the d minus 1 over q minus 1. Now, you just plug that into that expression there, where we needed to know the number of vertices fixed by gamma, and some cancellation occurs. Okay, plug into that formula. And we get that for this thing, our linear functional, when restricted to this small space of functions, comes out to be something relatively nice. It's this. All right, now these numbers here that are, these are going to be Schleicher germs. Okay, so we'll be discussing Schleicher germs, but those are the Schleicher germs for this torus, this unramified torus. This is the Schleicher germ for, remember, this guy here has to do with the trivial unipotent orbit, and this is the corresponding Schleicher germ. This has to do with the regular unipotent orbit. This is the corresponding Schleicher germ on that torus. I'll say what that means in a while. So we've calculated these things, and the form is surprisingly simple. It's simpler than you would expect from that stuff there because there was some cancellation that occurred. And we have something where these germs are functions of gamma. These are Schleicher germs, and they're functions of gamma. Well, they're germs of functions. Actually, we've only done this for those gammas sitting inside of here that are, well, they're in OE star, not in OF star. As we'll see, Schleicher germs really are, they're germs of functions about the identity element. What about the ramified case? Well, again, we take a quadratic extension. That's the same as before, except I'm just changing it, so E is now ramified. Which means that Q doesn't change anymore. We will have the same Q for both F and E. But still, something changes when you look at the small tree and the big tree, which one sits inside of the other, and what does the picture look like? Well, you have to think back to how the apartment looks. Just to understand why this is going to happen. Remember that our apartment is based upon something like this. Here's kind of the base point in the apartment. And then the next vertex you get is uniformizing element 0, 0, 1 up times V0. Now, when we were in the unramified case, the notion of uniformizing element doesn't change when you go to the quadratic extension. When we're in the ramified case, pi, which is a uniformizer for the small field, is the square of the uniformizer in the bigger field. What that means is when we go to the bigger, now I can draw the picture of what happens. Let me again start off with the usual thing. This is the small tree. Well, that stuff is still in there, but every one of these acquires, each edge acquires a new vertex in the middle. Okay, that's one thing that happens. They certainly have more vertices even inside the original thing. But now, of course, it's still, the queue has not changed, and every vertex must have three neighbors. Some of them do already, but say this one doesn't. So we need another guy coming out of there, etc. All right, and then of course it just keeps branching in the same way forever. Now again, we can solve our problem by going up to this bigger tree, finding the apartment that has to do with our particular torus. It'll be, again, a non-standard apartment. And the question is, how far is our point in the small tree from that apartment? But the answer comes out just slightly different from the unramified case. And let me try to draw the picture that explains that. So I'll be more sketchy about it because I've already kind of explained this stuff. I need to think for a second. Well, probably just draw that whole thing like this. Okay, I mean, again, in this ramified one, I want to do the same basic things. Okay, so we have our torus T. It's again E cross, all that's the same. We're interested in a unit, not in the small field. That's a non-standard apartment. It's the one you get for the torus T over E somehow. And the deal is now, instead of having that picture up there, we've got this picture here, where what are these two things in the lattice point of view? One of them, again, if we set things up in a similar way to before, and again, I'm writing lattices in, all the things written in white come from the small one. So that's a lattice in E, or an F squared. But you see, we actually get an obvious edge, namely there's the prime ideal, the maximal ideal in OE. And the one mod the other, it's different from the unramified case. The one mod the other is just one dimensional. So those guys are joined by an edge. They're joined by an edge in the small tree. Of course, when you go up to the bigger one, then they're sort of two edges apart. Anyway, this lets you answer your question. Namely, we see from this Therefore, there exists a unique integer, d sub gamma associated to gamma, with the property that, let me again draw a vertex here. Our question, to know whether V is fixed or not, we have to ask how far it is to that apartment. But when you join it to, because it's in the small tree, when you join it to this apartment, the way it's going to go is either it's going to hook up there or possibly at the other side. I mean, you don't know in advance which one. And the shortest path to the apartment will have to go through either this one or this one, which means that the distance to that apartment is the distance to this edge minus some constant thing. But anyway, there's some, there exists a d gamma such that the set of vertices fixed by gamma is just those vertices, such that the distance from the vertex to this edge here, to the edge, is less than or equal to d gamma. And by distance to the edge, I mean, of course, the shortest way. If you're on this side, you see how far you are to this one. If it hooks up to this one, you see how far you are to that. So the distance, I mean, you get zero for this point or this point, and then it just depends how far you are from those two points. And again, you can just add up the number of guys you get in this way. What's that? Not exactly, because of that vertical red line. That there's a shift by that the length of that vertical red line. If you're in the if it's ramified, the length of that vertical segment is zero, and then there's it doesn't get messed up. Then you can use this you can use that formula up there, and it works. But when it's wildly ramified, you really have that thing hanging down there. So here I'll just write as a fact. If you want a determinant in there's various ways of saying what d gamma is, but d gamma satisfies the following equation. 1 plus twice it is the soup of the valuations of gamma minus a, where a ranges through units in f. In other words, you see how close gamma is to an element in F. You measure the distance from gamma to the, which sits in E, to the one-dimensional subspace F. That's just a fact. And now we just add up how many of these things we've got and substitute back into this formula up here to get our result. It is on here. The number of fixed points is going to be, well, why do we get two? Because we get a contribution from the things to the left, and we get a contribution from the things to the right. That puts two here. The one is, that's the lattice point there. And then we get Q guys that are neighbors of that, and we get Q squared guys that are further neighbors of that, et cetera. And then this process comes to an end. It's limited by what d gamma is. So we get this, and that's equal to just a geometric progression. And then using that formula, substituting back into the general formula, we again get unexpected simplification when we do the algebra. and we get this. All right, so now these things are again Schleicher germs, but for this new torus, and you've got different values, they look similar, but they're a bit different. Well, the second one's the same. Yeah. Yeah, it's the one that's the norm. It's normalized valuation on the field E. It gives the uniformizer of E valuation 1. I'm working all the, yeah, we think about gamma simply as being an E. Okay? Yeah. No, you, no, just work in E or an E cross. We don't need to use the matrix form of it at all. All right, now I'm going to make this comment now, and I'll probably make it again. Something quite surprising has happened, although it won't be. It's early to say it because we don't have. I haven't talked about Schleicher germs yet and what they're good for. I guess in a sense, you might say the surprising thing already happened, which was that we had infinitely many gammas, and we have this infinite dimensional space, H. Nevertheless, every single one of these things turned out to be a linear combination of just two guys, and those themselves had simple interpretation as unipotent orbital integrals. Now, in the Schleicher germ stuff, it says that when you look at orbital integrals, not on these special functions, but just for any function. So take the orbital integral for gamma of just any function. But think about it, how it depends upon gamma as you vary gamma through the torus. The Schleicher germ expansion says it always has some form like this. You see, if you have one particular function, suppose we now plug in O gamma and then F, some function, not necessarily here. We'll have this number, and then this thing simply becomes a number. It's the value of this linear function on that function. So this thing here is just L1 just becomes a number. L0 becomes a number. And we think about it, we think about the thing as, what happens as gamma varies. So that these now are just constants, and it's the gamma that varies. Okay? And the Schleicher germ expansion says that when you have an arbitrary function, you will have such a linear combination like this, that when you look as the thing as a function of gamma, you'll have these Schleicher germs occurring with these coefficients coming from the values of those functionals. But here's the hitch. That germ expansion is a germ expansion. It only holds when gammas are very, very close to the identity, or that's what the theorem, that's what the general nonsense Schleicher germ expansion would say. That we would have such an identity when gamma is very, very close to the identity. But notice, our gammas are not terribly close to the identity. They're in K, which is a huge neighborhood of the identity. They're not in some tiny little congruent subgroup. Moreover, that neighborhood depends upon the function. Yet here we have infinitely many functions in this set algebra H. And we have a kind of uniform expansion on a huge neighborhood of the identity for all those functions at once. That's really strange. I mean, we should have been afraid that as you move the function around that the neighborhoods where the expansion worked would get smaller and smaller. Well, we already know that actually doesn't happen because we saw that on this guy H, everything is a combination of two functionals. That already means, in essence, we're working with two functions, which means that the germ expansion will hold on the intersection of the neighborhoods where the expansions hold for the two individual functions. So just the finite dimensionality said that actually we could find a neighborhood of the identity that works for all the functions. That part is clear. But what should be regarded as amazing is the fact that it works on this enormous neighborhood, K, and which is in some sense the biggest thing that would be even reasonable to ask about. So it's one of these situations that always happens in math where like the most optimistic thing you could imagine amazingly turns out to be true. But it's, in general, very hard to prove. Here we've proved it by direct calculation. You can't do that in general. You have to do something trickier. But Stephen DeMocker will discuss that. Now I want to talk about Schleicha germs just in that general kind of context. So Schleicha germs in general, and this is that reference that I gave. I know that I'm kind of overusing the letter O, but it's going to get even worse now because it's traditional to write the unipotent orbits. There's finitely many orbits of them, conjugacy classes of them. It's traditional to write them with an O. So sorry about that. Those are unipotent orbits. And each one we can use to form a unipotent orbital integral, and I'll write those. It's again sort of traditional to use mu for that. So these are now the orbital integrals corresponding to those unipotent orbits, unipotent orbital integrals. As we've seen, these Schleicha germs come about when you have a maximal torus, and you look at the behavior of orbital integrals as you vary the element gamma in the regular set in the torus. Well, let's do that. You take T contained in G, a maximal torus. And of course, inside of there, we've got the regular set. Those are the gammas where the roots aren't equal to 1. For GLN, it just means that the eigenvalues are distinct over the algebraic closure. But in general, it means the roots are not equal to 1 on that element. And now when we need to do like we did before, namely, when we work with all the various gammas, we're going to be considering gammas in here. When we work with all of them, we want the measures that we use to form the orbital integrals to be the same. So I will, when I take my gamma that's regular in the torus, and I take an orbital integral, it's important to choose the measures coherently, and in fact, the simplest thing to do is just make them always be the same. Okay, so we just fix this once and for all. And use it for all gamma. And then it becomes reasonable to study what happens as you change gamma. Okay, we've got the ingredients now. Let me state the theorem. This theorem serves as, I guess, in a sense, as the definition of the Schleicha germs. It tells you that it makes sense to talk about Schleicha germs. So the theorem says that there exist, and they really are only germs. So I will say exist non-unique. The germs are unique. I'll make that comment in a second. But there exist non-unique functions called Schleicha germs. On the regular elements in the torus, such that for every function, when we look at the orbital integrals of that function with respect to gammas in the regular set of that torus, all right, so we just, let me write all the quantifiers first. So given a function, there exists a neighborhood. That was what I was saying over here. It's not the other way around. The neighborhood depends upon the function. Given a function, there's a neighborhood small enough that something is true, but it depends upon the function. So given F, there exists a neighborhood, U of the identity element in the torus T, such that, and now we do what I was starting to say. We look up the orbital integrals of the given function F, and but we see how they behave as a function of gamma. And the statement is that as a function of gamma, they're simply a linear combination of the Schleicher germs, where the coefficients in that linear combination are given by the unipotent orbital integrals of F. But I can't write period because it's a germ expansion. We can't say it's going to be true for all gamma. It'll be for all gamma which are sufficiently close to the identity in the sense specified by the neighborhood U. So for all gamma that are regular and in U. Often you see this written maybe in a better in better notation. We can think of it as a sum over unipotent orbits, script O like that, and then often you write that unipotent orbital integral as mu sub O, and often you write the Schleicher germ that corresponds to it as gamma sub O. Okay, that's just a different system for writing it down that's often used. And as a remark, let me just say that we'll see in the course of proving this that these functions, while not unique, the germs about the identity element are uniquely determined. So remark, the germs of gamma 1 through gamma r at 1 in T are unique. Yes, it is because of the germ expansion theory. There are some numbers that go there that work for all functions. All right. There are some linear combinations that work for all functions. That's the content of this theorem,
right.
And they're independent of the functions. And so we had enough functions to tell what they were. That's correct. No. That's absolutely, yes. So the question was, yeah. We proved this. So this is the Schleicher germ expansion for the functions in here. But on GL2, we don't know this yet, all right? Because this is just something about these functions here. So even for GL2, this statement is something we don't know yet. In reality, what we want to do is, after proving this, then you sort of want to go back and think about it again, kind of cycle through the process. Think about what we did here. Compare it against what's over there, and then sort of see what's going on. Yeah, thanks. That's actually important to bear in mind. Yeah. Yeah.
It can be.
It's simpler. The more split it is, the simpler it is. That's right. I mean, somehow there's a parabolic descent that goes on. And what happens is, if you have a torus which is not elliptic, you can take a split part, take the centralizer of that to get a leady, and then you have your torus being elliptic inside of that leady, and the Schleicher germ theory on the group and on the leady will be really the same, which means if you start with something which is a split torus, the leady is the torus, and the germ theory on the group is really basically the germ theory in the torus. The germ theory in the torus, okay, it's more or less a triviality. And that's sort of an explanation of why it was so simple on the split torus. Yeah. The elliptic case is really the essential one. That's right. Let's start on the proof. Yeah, I think we're doing pretty well on time. Well, we'll need various things. So there are little lemmas kind of that are worth knowing embedded in this proof. I won't sort them out as separate things, but just we'll have to develop various things to carry out this proof. Maybe the first thing to say is let's order the orbits. I just took them in random order before, but let's order the orbits such that I want the very first one to be closed. Well, there is such a one. I mean, just the trivial orbit containing one. That's closed. Of course, if we take the unit of all of them, that's the whole unipotent set, and that's also closed. You can take a faithful representation, and you're looking where the characteristic polynomial has the right thing for the guy to be unipotent. And those are closed conditions. You're imposing equality of certain, I mean, you're saying certain functions are equal to certain values. Those are closed conditions. So the unipotent set is, as a whole is closed. In the case of GL2, where there's just two orbits, that means, well, you take a trivial one, and then the two together are also closed. But in general, what I want to do is to have it be like this, that the first one is closed, and then also if we take the union of the first two, that's closed, and then if we take the union of the first three, that's closed, are all closed in G. And probably the easiest way to see that you can do that is to use a little bit of algebraic geometry to actually work with the algebraic group orbits first, then pass to the locally compact group, and then you have a little bit of arguing with Galois cohomology to see that you can go from the algebraic group to the locally compact group. I'm not going to actually carry it out, but it's a fact that you can do this, and for GL2, as I say, it's obvious. You just take the semi-simple one, just the trivial orbit, and then the other one. You can always do that, and you'll see why we want to do it in a bit. We'll sort of analyze things inductively, starting off with the trivial orbit, O1, where everything's really easy, and then you just go up step by step, adding another orbit each time as you go. Okay, so one of the things that's embedded in the proof is a definition. If we have any one of these kinds of topological spaces that we're working with, locally compact, totally disconnected, so suppose we have LC, TD, space, X, what do we mean by a distribution on there? The distributions, I'll write it as D of X, but the D is for distribution. A distribution on X is just any linear functional from the function space we're using. So it's HOM. There's no topology involved here. It's just linear maps. And the functions we use, of course, are the locally constant, compact, and supported ones. All right, so those things are distributions. There's a very basic fact about these functions when we have an open and closed set. I mean, for example, here we have this thing, which is itself a closed set in G, and it's the union of something which is closed and something that's open. All right, so now more generally, I want to just consider that situation. Suppose we've got X, which is one of our spaces, locally compact, totally disconnected. And suppose we've got a closed and an open in there, which are complementary. So open, closed, and they're complementary. That means that you have to check this, but both U and Y are again spaces obeying the same axioms. They're again LCTD. We can form these function spaces. We can form the distribution spaces on them. And it's a simple thing which you should check that we get exact sequences in this situation. There's nothing deep going on. You just have to exploit the definition of what an LCTD space is to see that this works. And dually, taking Palm into C, it's going to go the other direction. The maps are as follows. If you've got a locally constant, compactly supported function on U, you just extend it by zero to make it a function on X. If you have a locally constant, compactly supported function on X, you just restrict it to the closed set Y, and it's still compactly supported, so that's okay. Going the other way, you have these maps on distributions. Distributions actually form a sheaf. If you have a distribution on X, it gives you, by restriction, a distribution on the open set U. And the kernel, the distributions which restrict to zero on U are the ones that are supported on Y. So the way you usually say it is, because of this inclusion here, a distribution on Y is just a special sort of distribution on X. Namely, it's a distribution on X supported on Y. Those are the words you would use. Now suppose that we're in a situation where we've got a group action. Suppose that we still have X and U and Y, and suppose we just have some group. This can be an abstract group. It doesn't really matter. In our applications, it won't be. It'll be an LCTD group, but it doesn't matter for this definition. So just suppose that G acts on X, preserving both of, well, since they're complementary, if it preserves one, it preserves the other, but anyway, preserving that decomposition. Then, of course, it acts on all these function spaces, the group does, and it, by duality, it acts in all the spaces of distributions. And what I want to think about are co-invariants for the group action on the functions and the invariants for the group action on the distributions. But the two things are dual to each other. So we get two things. Maybe I'll start with the co-invariants. We take the co-invariants. Remember how that worked. If you have a representation G of G on V, then the co-invariants were given by V mod all guys of the form GV minus V. Okay, you take V mod the linear span of GV minus V for all G all V. That's the co-invariants. But taking co-invariants, that's the thing that gives rise to group homology. It's exact, and it's halfway exact. Okay, so it's whatever it's called. It's right exact, I guess, because we're having this good stuff on the right. All right, so it's co-invariants are right exact. They're actually a tensor product, and it's just a special case of right exactness of tensor products. The dual thing is, now suppose we take the dual of this. So take HOM C of this sequence here. And the thing is, just by the way the co-invariants are defined, if you give a linear map from this space to, just give a linear map on this quotient space, that's the same as the linear map on the original space that kills all these things. In other words, such that it's G invariant when you sort of unwind it. It's G invariant. So when you take the dual, you simply get at this end the distributions which are G invariant. And now the arrows are going the other way. Okay, so this comes from this short exact sequence, and now when you take invariance under the group action, that is left exact, as we're seeing here. Okay, why did I go through these things? Because what I want to do now is to use these considerations to analyze invariant distributions on our group, where the group acting on the group is itself. I mean, G acting on G by conjugation, all right? But we'll have to analyze various things. We need to consider the whole unipotent set sitting inside of G as a closed set. That gives us an example like this. But then also, we have all these intermediate pieces, too. And here's how the analysis goes. But we use these considerations to understand about, we need to understand invariant distributions on the group supported on the unipotent set. That's what we're trying to do now. And we have the right general things to do that. So now analyze invariant distributions on G supported on, and I'll just write U for it. That's the unipotent set. Instead of all unipotent elements, I'll just write it as U. Script U. Action is conjugation. Action is conjugation. G acts on G by conjugation. Well, the very first pair of an open and close that we should use is just the starting point that I already indicated, where we have O1 union O2, and that gives us O1 sitting as something closed in the union, and then the complementary O2, that's open. O2 is open in that union. Of course, it's not open in the group G, but it's open in here. And so now let's think about what happens with invariant distributions. We get on invariant distributions this portion of a short exact sequence. It'll actually turn out to be an exact sequence. Just these general considerations alone only give us this portion of a short exact sequence, but we have to worry about whether this is surjective or not. Let's think about it just for a second. Here we're looking at functions on a single orbit. I mean, these are distributions on this orbit. We're looking at the dual of functions on that orbit. But we're taking distributions that are G invariant. That's just a G invariant way of assigning a number to a function on that orbit. But we already talked about that situation. The only way to do that is just integrate using the invariant measure. So that's one-dimensional. It just comes from integration over the orbit. So this is one-dimensional, and the generator is obtained by an orbital integral over that orbit. Okay, this is one-dimensional, spanned by basically by mu1. I mean, mu1 is really a distribution on the entire group, but remember, it's supported on O1, and so we can sort of think about it this way as being actually sitting inside of there. Same story here. This is one-dimensional, and it's spanned by mu2, essentially by mu2. But we have to worry about whether is there a G-invariant distribution on the union of the two orbits which maps to this thing, which restricts to that one. The thing is, by the theorem of Rao, we know that the answer is yes. Because on here, we have, again, mu2. Remember, so we really have mu2 also as a convergent orbital integral on the entire functions on the whole group. And so you take your function on the whole group, you restrict it to the union of the two orbits, and then you carry out integration over that thing. And so we do get something that maps to this, and this, but it's not formal. I mean, this is because of the convergence of unipotent orbital integrals that this works, which means that actually this is surjective, and this thing is two-dimensional. We now know exactly what's going on. There's a two-dimensional space of invariant distributions on the union of the two orbits. Well, now you just continue inductively, and you use the same thing step by step. The next thing we would do, of course, this is closed, and this is open in here. So now you go step by step, and we end up with a final conclusion that when we look at the invariant distribution supported on the unipotent set, that is going to be r-dimensional, and the basis will be given by mu1 through mu r. All right, that's what we get so far out of these considerations. So continue. Conclude, if we look at distributions on the unipotent set that are G invariant, that has basis, C basis, just these unipotent orbital integrals. In particular, then we know that these guys are linearly independent. In the course of doing this, we've seen that those things are linearly independent linear functions. Because they're linearly independent, we can choose sort of a dual basis. I mean, well, they're not a basis for the space of linear functionals when we think about them on the group. But what I want to do is the following. So we pick. These are non-unique functions, F1 through FR. These are functions on the group, which are kind of a dual basis to mu1 through mu r in the sense that mu sub I on F sub j is the Kronecker-Della. So, of course, the F sub j's are not unique. You can modify them in, as long as you change by a function, all of whose unipotent orbital integrals are zero. And there's lots of such functions. But anyway, by the linear independence of mu1 through r, mu r, these things at least exist, even though they're not unique. Now, when you go back to the theorem right up here, suppose that we, you know, as usual, when you try to prove a theorem, you assume the theorem is true just to sort of see what's going on. All right, so let's grant that the theorem works, and now insert one of these functions right here into the statement of the theorem. If you insert that a function like this into the statement of the theorem, we've just picked something where when we look at the orbital integrals of the function, there's just one, I mean, they're all zero except for one of them, where you get one. And then the statement reduces to saying that the ith Schleicher germ is equal to the orbital integrals for gamma of F sub I. That's just what it says. All right, so we see from theorem that we should now define gamma sub I as gamma by, we are forced to do this, gamma sub I of gamma equals by definition orbital integral for gamma of the ith function. To make the theorem work, we have to do that. Of course, we don't know that the theorem works, but if the theorem is going to work, we have to do that. Well, how do we now prove the theorem? Oh, wait a minute. Wow, I thought I was doing great on time, but it seems no. All right, well, we're kind of right in the middle of it, but still I think it'll work because what we've done is we've arrived at the stage where we know what we need to take these things to be, and then we just have to prove that that equality does hold. That's all. I'll do that next time.